With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
War has played a key role in the history of the United States, from the nation's founding right down to the present. War made the U.S. independent, kept it together, increased its size, and established it as a global superpower. Understanding America's wars is essential for understanding American history. Welcome to Key Battles of American History, a podcast in which we discuss American history through the lens of the most important battles of America's wars. Here is your host, James Early.
Welcome to another special episode of Key Battles of World War I. I'm your host, James Early. This is another of a projected mini-series of episodes in which a guest and I will discuss several of the best movies about World War I. In today's episode, we will discuss the classic, award-winning, all-American 1941 film, Sergeant York. My guest is a fellow history fanatic and World War I and World War II buff, Sean McIver. Sean is a co-host of the excellent podcast Come and Take It, which I strongly recommend that you check out. Sean is also a major movie aficionado, so he's the perfect person to have with me today. I'm excited to have him again. Sean, how you doing?
Well, as they would say in this movie, tolerable well.
All right, that's great. We're going to have a lot of fun with this one. So before we jump into the movie, let me give some of the basic information about the movie. Sergeant York was released in 1941, and it stars Gary Cooper, of course. Gary Cooper, the legendary American actor who plays the title role, Alvin C. York. Also stars Walter Brennan, Joan Leslie, George Tobias, and Stanley Ridges, and quite a few other people. It was directed by Howard Hawks. It's 2 hours and 14 minutes, and it won awards, including Best Actor for Gary Cooper. And it's just an iconic American film. A lot of people have seen it. I think just about every history buff has seen it. On Rotten Tomatoes, it gets a rating of 88% from the critics and 87% from the audience. So that's pretty consistent. That's, of course, very high. IMDb gives it their 7.7 out of 10, which is also a respectable rating. It's in black and white, as most of the movies from that time are. And it's just a great, fun movie. And Sean, what else would you like to say about the movie just overall?
Yeah, well, the movie was directed by the legendary director Howard Hawks, who had been in film since 1916. His career in film lasted from 1916 until 1970. And his directing career lasted from about 1925 until 1970. So he had a very, very long film career. He is one of the pioneering filmmakers. He didn't invent the screwball comedy, but he perfected it with His Girl Friday and a number of other films. He also was a legendary Western director. Probably his most famous Western was Red River with John Wayne. And he directed it's a debatable whether he directed or not. The movie, one of the classic monster movies of the 1950s, he certainly produced and wrote it, The Thing from Another World. So he just had a long and varied career. He worked a great deal with Gary Cooper. They were close friends. He worked a lot more, actually, with Walter Brennan. He actually worked a lot with John Wayne. Later, he remade the movie Rio Bravo, El Dorado, those movies. He remade them three times. He liked the story so much of the sheriff, the drunken deputy, and the young gunsmith. So he's just a legendary director. He's along the lines of the John Ford in terms of just being this classic director. And this was one of his most popular films, and it was one of his most well awarded films as well. So it's a great film, and looking forward to it.
All right. Thanks, Sean. See, folks, Sean has seen every movie ever made. He knows so much about movies. You're like, you are the human movie database. You're the HMDB. That's why I pay you the big bucks to do these shows. Anyway. All right. So the movie opens in rural Tennessee. And when we say rural, folks, we mean very, very rural. As Sean pointed out to me when we were talking earlier, other than a few outsiders coming in, this area has changed very little since the 19th or even 18th century. I mean, it is country. Rural, yes. Right?
Yes. Oh, yes. They talk about Daniel Boone as if he was just had left.
Exactly. The area. You can, you know, the speech, they have a very unique dialect, and I think Gary Cooper does a good job of capturing it.
Yeah.
So it starts out with in a church service, and the church service is interrupted by men outside riding horses and firing guns, hooting and hollering and just raising a ruckus. One of these men is Alvin York, and later in a general store run by the pastor of the church, Pastor Pyle, a group of men talk about more of York's antics. So York is kind of legendary for his rebel rousing and causing problems. Alvin's mother shows up and she arrives. She asks the pastor to talk to him, to talk to Alvin, that is. Alvin and his friends go to a bar and it's looking like trouble's going to occur. Alvin's brother George arrives to take Alvin home. But on the way out, Alvin can't even get out the door without getting into a fight. So it turns into a barroom brawl.
Yeah, these early scenes are great. They do set the stage for the story and what's going on. The pastor, Pastor Pyle, is played by the legendary Walter Brennan, who basically spent his entire career being a crotchety old man. Even, you know, from his 30s on, he got his teeth knocked out. He was an extra, and he got his teeth knocked out in the film. And he said it made him age 40 years. It was the best break of his life. He actually is one of the few men to have the few people to have 4 Oscars. So he's a pretty remarkable person. Was in a ton of movies with Gary Cooper. They were close friends. He was very close friends with Howard Hawks. And then the other thing, I love character actors. And so Walter Brennan's one of my favorite character actors. One of Alvin's friends is the great Ward Bond, my favorite character actor of all time. If you know who Ward Bond is, if you've seen any John Wayne movie, you've seen Ward Bond. And if you saw Wagon Train for the first several years, he was the star of Wagon Train until he passed away. So he's quite young in this film. He's the cop in It's a Wonderful Life. You know who I'm talking about. And then what I love about the scene in the store is you learn how isolated the valley is. And so there's a salesman there who's selling hats and women's unmentionables. To the pastor who also runs the general store and is the postman. He's sort of one of those, you know, all jack of all trades for the town. But the people talk about, they knew Cordell Hull, who is the U.S. representative and later Secretary of State. He's from the area, actually, in history, in real life. He was raised about 20 miles away from Alvin York. Their birthplaces have national parks very close to each other. The other thing you find out that there's a war going on in Europe, and these folks don't care much about it because the salesman brings it up about the war in Europe. And the men say, well, if you're looking for trouble, you've come to the right place. I don't want any trouble. And they don't care much about the war in Europe. They only care about what's in their valley. And he asks how they get there. And they say, you have to be born here. So this is a great scene where you find out that this world in this valley of the Three Forks is very much outside of the rest of the world. They are very separated from everything. It's an older time in this town, and you can definitely see it. This scene could come out of a Western movie, you know, from Arizona in the 1870s, you know, pretty much. So great scenes, great sequences. And of course, at the end, you know, at the end of this scene, where they go to the bar and they get in the fight, and his brother George comes and says, my favorite line in the whole movie, Ma wants you, Alvin. Ma wants you.
yes.
I just love that scene, that line.
Folks, Sean has already quoted this line to me like 5 times in the last week, ever since we first started talking about doing this movie. But it's really good. All right, so Alvin goes home. And while he's at home, he's out working in the fields. Pastor Pyle visits him and tries to persuade him to give his life to God, but Alvin declines. Later, he goes out fox hunting, and while he's fox hunting, he stops to talk to Gracie Williams, a very young, beautiful young lady, who he later asks to marry him, and he realizes he really wants to have his own plot of land, so he works odd jobs day and night, very hard work. He competes in a shooting competition to try to raise money to buy his own plot of land so that he can have a house of his own one day. And Alvin shows what a great shot he is when he wins the contest. And Sean's going to talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But the owner of the land that Alvin is wanting to buy, despite having promised it to Alvin, at least unofficially, there was no contract or anything. He had promised it to Alvin, but he sells it to another man named Zeb. And this man, Zeb, bought it just to spite Alvin because Gracie had chosen Alvin over Zeb.
Yeah, and so Gracie is played by Joan Leslie. She's a very lovely actress. She didn't do a lot of films. She was a teenage actress. She was actually 15 when she did this film. And she was 24 years younger than Gary Cooper. Gary Cooper was 40 playing 30. She was 15 playing about 18 or 19. She later said in an interview that he gave her a doll on the set. That was how he, and so they were supposed to be doing these, you know, kissing love scenes. She's 15 and he's 40.
Awkward.
Awkward. Yeah. Very awkward. The interesting thing about this sequence is that Alvin's family is very poor. They're dirt poor. But they live up in the mountains and their land is full of rocks. His father and his grandfather work that land and Alvin works that land and it's very difficult. He has to constantly pull up rocks out of the land and plow around giant rocks that he can't move and trees. And he wants some bottom land. He wants some low land so that he can have a home for Gracie because she's in a farm down in the lower part of the land. And Zeb is a wealthy farmer and his father, they have bottom land as well. And so it's kind of a class issue at this point in that, you know, the very dirt poor people work the poor lands. The more wealthy, well-to-do people in the area, even though by today's standards they would all be considered poor, they have better land in the bottom land. And Alvin works his tail off. You know, he's a hard worker. That's the character of him. He is a drinker and a hellraiser, but also he's determined. And he's when he puts his mind to something, he's going to do it. And so he works almost 24 hours a day for a whole month to try to raise up enough money to get this land. And I think it's something like $100 for the land. And he's got to come up with $100. He comes up with about 40. It takes him a whole month to come up with about $60. So that's the kind of situation we're talking about here in 1916, 1917. The contest that he wins is a shooting contest, and they're trying to shoot a turkey that is behind a log and it,
yeah,
and
he's reluctant to get shot, isn't he?
Yeah, the turkey's very reluctant. Nobody can get him. And so Alvin wants to win the turkey so that he can get then at the end the turkey shoot, then they'll have an actual shooting contest with targets and you pay $1 per shot. And so he has $4, he wants to get five, so he wants to win that turkey and sell it for $1 so he can get an extra shot. And he ends up winning shooting the turkey because he makes a sound. He goes gobble, gobble, and the turkey pops his head up and he shoots him. So remember that he gobbles to pop that turkey's head up.
Yeah, it just might come back again later, that idea. Yeah. All right, so Alvin the impression is that he had kind of given up his drinking and his carousing for a while, but he gets pretty depressed about losing the land. And so one day he goes back to drinking and carousing. And one day he decides to get revenge on Zeb. So he gets on his horse and he takes his gun. On the way, though, Alvin's gun is struck by lightning and he's knocked off his horse. It's a very dramatic scene. And then he hears singing in the church, which is very close to where he is at the time. The church is having a service. He walks into the church and there he dedicates his life to God. And he decides to make things right with the man who sold the land to Zeb and with also with Zeb himself. In fact, he even agrees that he's going to sharecrop the land for Zeb, hoping to get title to it eventually. In other words, he'll work on the land, not owning the land, but gradually earning the title to it.
And he even tries to convince Gracie to marry Zeb.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that detail.
Yeah,
yes.
He tries to talk her into it, and she She had earlier kissed him when she found out he was trying to save up the money to marry her. And so she said, I done kissed you. What else you think I'm going to do? I'm going to marry you, Alvin York.
Right.
So it's a wonderful little scene there. This is a great sequence of the old Paul on the road to Damascus redemption story. And there's a great, you know, the great sequence where he gets knocked off the horse and the horse's horseshoes are knocked off of it. I think it's actually a mule, not a horse.
Okay.
But it blows its horseshoes off of him, and it turns his gun into a necktie, into a twisted up piece of metal, burnt up metal. But he goes into that church and they're singing, Give Me That Old Time Religion, the great scene where he becomes saved. Mm-hmm. So it's a really, really nice sequence.
Yeah, I thought about Martin Luther for some reason with that scene, because Luther was stuck in a lightning storm one time and he promised God that, you know, if he lived, that he would dedicate his life more fully to God. Oh, yeah. If I remember the story correctly, I haven't studied anything about Luther in ages, but anyway, yeah. So I don't know why I thought of that.
No, okay. I mean, that's good. That's evocative of an older of religious traditions that people would have known.
Right. Okay. So a writer approaches and he announces that the U.S. has declared war against Germany. Many men in town join up immediately or they register for the draft, but Alvin refuses to do either of these because he believes that killing is not allowed for a Christian. More on that in just a minute. So Alvin applies to be a conscientious objector, but the application is denied. He is drafted and he is ordered to report to training camp. He sadly bids farewell to Gracie and his family, and then he asks his mother in the final scene before they move on to the next part. He says, Ma, what are they fighting for? She replies, I don't know. I don't rightly know. It's good stuff.
Yeah. So Alvin York was a member of the Christian Union denomination, which had broken away from the Methodist Church during the American Civil War because of the Northern Methodist Church and the Southern Methodist Church's politicization during the Civil War. Both sides had declared that God was on the side that they were on and that the men should fight. And the Northern side said they should fight to free the slaves, and the Southern side said that they should fight to defend the South and to keep the slaves enslaved. And so members of the Christian Union denomination broke away and they adopted pacifism and an opposition to politicization of the church. And they also adopted some nonconformist country style practices that a lot of Southern rural churches did, like not being ecumenical, not being part of a denominations, no musical instruments, kind of like the Church of Christ. So
yeah, it seemed based on the sorry to interrupt, but I was just thinking, it seems like they see, well, according to the presentation of what the church does in the movie, I got the impression that they'd gotten rid of some of the liturgical stuff that the Methodists were still holding on to. It seemed very much like a Church of Christ service to me.
Yeah, very, very primitive, even lower than low church. And women, if you notice, the men are on one side and the women on the other side in this little clapboard church. So, the Alvin York was a really member of that sect of Christianity, and he was, that sect did have a history of pacifism, but they were not recognized by the government in the same way that Jehovah's Witnesses or Christian Science or other Quakers, for example, had a long history of not of being pacifists, right, and of being conscientious objectors. So that was what the real historical Alvin York was coming from, was his particular denomination had espoused pacifism. The other thing to note is his family. His sister is played by June Lockhart, and so those of you who love MeTV will know that June Lockhart certainly did play the mother on Lassie and in Lost in Space. And she's very young. She's about 15 also in this film.
All right. Yeah, I've heard of June Lockhart. I don't know near as much about old actors in the classic age of cinema as you do, Sean, but that one I do remember. Yes.
She's how about easy that? To recognize.
Okay. So now I just want to say one other thing too. get your opinion on something, Sean. That this movie, unlike All Quiet on the Western Front and unlike Paths of Glory, this is definitely not in any stretch of the imagination an anti-war film. This is obviously, this came out right around the time the U.S. was about to jump into World War II. And it seems like it's a very pro, I don't know about pro-war, but, you know, pro-America. Certainly, it's a patriotic film. And yet, this one line struck me. I don't normally put specific lines into my notes, but the one where he says, "Ma, what are they fighting for?" I don't know. I don't really know. It just seems almost like just a tiny bit of at least questioning war. Did you mm-hmm. get that impression, Sean?
James here. And now a brief word from our sponsors.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
I have a theory about this, and we can go into this now, or we can wait until the end of the
Let's wait till the end. I think maybe the end would be a better place because we'll talk some more meta stuff. But
right. But I'll give you an expression that I just came up with off the top of my head, but it's reluctant patriotism.
Interesting.
So think about that, and I think I'll expand upon it.
All right, listeners, y'all think about it too, and we look forward to hearing what Sean has to say about that. Okay, let's move on to the second major part of the film. This is at Camp Gordon, Georgia. This is training camp. And so Alvin goes to training camp, and while he's there, he meets several other new soldiers, including a man from New York City named Pusher. You've got to have one either New York City or New Jersey guy in every movie like this. There's always a guy with the classic accent, you know, who there's always a country hick too, right, Sean? And there's always culture shock. It's almost like a trope, you know, it's a standard thing in all war movies. But
your star is the country hick, so.
Yeah, a lot of and they don't understand each other. They have this talk about what's a subway and all that, because Pusher works in the subway. He pushes people around. But Alvin also meets his new sergeant, and the sergeant's name is Bernard Early. So yay, a guy named Early. I don't think I'm related to him. I'd never heard of him before I did my research for this, but. Anyway, so there is a shooting practice one day out on the range, and Alvin impresses everyone with his marksmanship. Later, after when he's back at the barracks, he has a discussion with his friends on how to shoot a line of turkeys back to front, which a lot of them didn't have much experience with. And he uses this technique later, by the way, against German soldiers. Sean is going to fill us in a little bit more with the details about that.
So Pusher was played by George Tobias, who, again, fans of MeTV years later would know he is the nosy neighbor, Abner Kravitz from Bewitched, from the show Bewitched. He was on for the whole series of that show. So you'll recognize he's much younger. He's, you know, obviously 20 years before. Sergeant Early is actually warned by one of the officers to watch out for Alvin because he's a pacifist. He's a conscientious objector. And so they think he's going to be a shirker. They think he's going to cause trouble and badmouth the army to the other men and the soldier and be a bad example in the unit. But it's very clear that he works hard. They have him digging ditches, which, you know, that's what you have. Well, that's actually a good skill to have during World War One, because digging ditches is critical to fighting in this particular war.
Yeah,
digging trenches. But as you can see, he's very polite and he's very obedient and he does what he's supposed to do. And he does impress everyone with his marksmanship. He says, "Well, I ain't never seen anything here as fancy as this here rifle gun." Calls it a rifle gun. And they don't think he says he's never seen one of these before. They think he's never seen a rifle, when in fact, you know, he's seen a rifle. He says that around where I'm come from, they said I could shoot before I was weaned, but they was exaggerating. he kind of repeats his performance on the firing line that he had in the competition where he shoots the perfect, you know, bullseyes on all the targets. He does that again in the army. But when he explains the line of turkeys, this is a technique, like we said, we're going to use against the German soldiers. You shoot the one at the rear. You don't shoot the one at the front. So,
yeah, because if you shoot the one in the front, he falls down and the other guys are going to hit the deck, right?
Right.
They're run for cover. But if you hit the one in the rear, the four guys or so in front of him don't necessarily know that he's been hit. And so you can take out more that way.
Yeah. And this goes back to another American trope, or particularly American trope, which is the Omen soldier, the farmer soldier, mm-hmm. Back to the Minutemen days, that the techniques that we learn on the frontier, the Americans learn for self, you know, preservation and sustenance, actually make us better soldiers and better fighters. And, you know, this is certainly a trope that kind of illustrates that.
Yeah. Regarding the fancy rifles, I wanted to touch on that for just a second. Of course, the one he's using with the army is the 1903 Springfield mm-hmm. bolt action rifle with the five round clip. When he was shooting back in Tennessee, it looked like at the shooting competition, and maybe I'm imagining this, or maybe I didn't see the right thing, but it looked like he was using a muzzle loading black powder rifle.
Oh, they certainly were. All of them were. They were all carrying around muzzle loading percussion cap Kentucky rifles.
Yeah.
Basically. So, yeah. No, no.
That is a big change.
You did not miss see that. These are 200 year old rifles.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So,
yeah. Or 100, at least 100 year old rifles. Yeah.
He would have definitely been amazed by the Springfield 1903, but he took to it very quickly.
There's actually an error in the historicity of this scene. York and most of the troops, or at least two-thirds of the troops, American troops during the war, did not actually use Springfields. They used an American version of the Enfield rifle. And so Alvin York specifically used an Enfield rifle, which looked kind of similar to the 1903, and it used the same 30-06 cartridge. But yeah, they didn't have very many of those left. They'd given a lot to the British at that point, early in the Second World War. So a lot of the stocks of Enfield rifles that they'd kept from the previous war actually went back to the British. But so they used Springfields at that time.
Well, that's interesting. I did not know that his unit didn't use Springfields, huh?
Yeah, the main ones who used the Springfield were the Marines, who were and the first infantry, the cadres of original active military, active army, and active Marine Corps who were first sent to France, they were the ones mostly issued. But Springfield, the Springfield armory could not keep up with the production demand that was in place. So the British had already asked the Americans to start making the infields, and the production lines were able to fulfill those much more quickly. Remington and mm-hmm. Winchester and Colt were all able to produce a lot of those.
All right, good stuff. That's cool.
Military minutia.
Yes. That's
what you come here for.
Yes. Why not? We give you a little of everything. So then in the next scene, Alvin's commander calls him into his office. His name is Major Buxton, and he offers to promote him to corporal and to make him an instructor. And also the XO, the captain, is there as well. What's the captain's name? I forgot the captain's name.
It is,
did not write it down.
Captain Danforth.
Okay. Alvin at first declines this promotion. The major gives him a book on American history and sends him on leave for 10 days to think about it. And they also, part of it is, Alvin's objection is theological. He doesn't think it's right for him to teach other people to kill. And he doesn't, they get into a theological discussion, which Sean's going to talk about a little bit later. But anyway, so Alvin goes on leave for 10 days. He goes home to think and pray about the offer. And then there's a dramatic scene where Alvin is sitting all by himself out in the, out somewhere outside, and he's praying. His Bible, like the wind blows his Bible open to a passage, and the passage is, "Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and unto God what is God's." Alvin takes this as a sign from God that he should accept the promotion. So when he returns to camp, he accepts it.
This scene is wonderful, ridiculous, and fanciful. He's sitting on this promontory, this rock, and he sees the beauty of the creation of this of the Appalachian Mountains. It's very silly, but it's effective and it works. The debate that he has with the captain on fine points of theology, I thought his grasp was quite strong for someone without a formal education. He's able to parry with the obviously educated captain quite effectively. So for someone who could barely read, and the only book he'd ever read was probably the Bible, earlier on, Walter Brennan's character, the pastor, tells Alvin, you got the living kind of faith, the doing kind, and not the thinking kind. And so, he's very much, he's got a very good, strong grasp of practical theology, and he does very well with it. But it's the patriotic book, really, and it's the inclusion of Daniel Boone. He flips it over to, oh, that's Daniel Boone. You know who Daniel Boone is, son? He says, oh, everybody around where I'm from knows Daniel Boone. So, it's that simplification of the American story that speaks to Alvin. It spoke to the real Alvin York. He claims that is actually exactly what happened. And, it would have spoken to a lot of Americans in 1941 who were, especially rural Americans, but really a lot of Americans were quite religious at the time, especially having gone through the Great Depression, 10 to 12 years of the Great Depression. They would have, been quite religious and would have known a lot of these stories about American history and about the Bible.
All right. So now Alvin is a corporal, and we move to the third major part of the film, which takes place in France. And this is the Meuse-Argonne Offensive, October 8, 1918. Alvin and his unit are in a trench on the front line. They're ordered to charge the German position, and when they do, they suffer great losses. A group of German machine gun nests is wreaking the most havoc. Sergeant Early, Alvin, and a few other soldiers are ordered to take out the nest. And hand fighting ensues. It's really just bloody, I don't know what the word is, ugly fighting, right, Sean?
Yeah. So I want us to do a little bit of math here because we just recently celebrated 2 years ago.
It's a history podcast, but why not work with some math?
A little bit of math. So what day is Armistice Day?
November 11th.
What year?
1918.
Yeah. This is October 8th. They're only going to fight for another 33 days. So,
right. Yeah.
You don't realize America declared war in 1917 and the war was over in November of 1918. You don't realize really the Americans had only been fighting since about March. They'd only actually actively been fighting since about March of 1918. A very small bit, some observers and some special units had been with the British back in at the end of 1917 at Cambrai. But for the most part, Katangi and Belleau Wood were in March, April of 1918, to help blunt the German offensive. And within a few months, the war was over. And most American troops only saw this action in this last month of the war, of the fighting war. So, that's the thing. And you think about how many Americans did die during the First World War and died in combat. And that's the intensity of this war. There's also a great little scene right before the fighting part where they're in the trench with these grizzled old veterans that are British troops. And they give them tips on surviving in the trenches and surviving, you know, knowing which shells, which artillery shells are the ones you don't, you have to duck, and which ones are the ones you can't, and which are the ones you can ignore. And so and that reminded me of the veterans that Cat in Cat's unit on All Quiet on the Western Front, in that scene when the young troops arrive in the German trenches. It made me think back to that. And I think, again, this is just another tropic thing that, you know, the veterans are going to show the youngsters, this is how you survive. And they all look, they're all old. They're, you know, there's two guys, they're old men.
They probably look a lot older than they are, really.
Right, I mean, exactly.
Four ages, yeah.
Yeah, and then the other thing is in the attack, when they actually go over the line, they charge from their trenches, that scene looks just like the sequence, which would have been at that point 10 years before in film, of From All Quiet on the Western Front, which speaks to the historicity of All Quiet on the Western Front, in that if you go back and you look at, you know, Shoulder Arms, and you go back and you look at the that jerky film from the Somme and from Verdun and things like that, from the actual combat, they look like that, and that's what it looked like. So they do a very good job of showing the advance through the wire towards the German lines.
All righty. Well, let's see what happens next. Alvin's unit, which has just 17 guys, they end up behind German lines. They run into a group of Germans who surrender, and a machine gun then attacks the Americans. Sergeant Early is wounded in this attack, and he passes the command of the unit to Alvin. Alvin crawls alone to the nest, and then he sneaks up behind it, and he kills all the Germans in it. From there, he picks off the Germans in another nest. Then he shoots several other Germans in a nearby trench. The remaining Germans in the trench surrender to him, and Alvin orders them to march down the hill toward the American position. But one of the Germans pulls out a grenade. He throws it at the Americans, and Pusher, sadly, is killed. Alvin tells the German commander to order another group of passing Germans to surrender, and they do. And by the time Alvin and the Germans reach the American lines and Alvin drops them off, there are 132 prisoners. Alvin has only seven men with him of the original. Well, there's eight now, including Alvin, but there were originally 17, so about half. And they're all out of ammunition. So this is a great scene. As far as I can tell from my research, which is not, I'm not a big expert on this, the real historical event. I have read quite a bit about it, but this is actually quite accurate.
James here, and now a brief word from our sponsors. Text the word BATTLES, BATTLES, to 30605, and I'll send you a link to a wonderful product that can help you finally succeed in shedding that extra weight. Lily in Tennessee lost 42 pounds with Calitrin. Jeff in Indiana lost 55 pounds. Beth said her joint aches have eased up considerably and she is sleeping so much better. Text the word BATTLES, BATTLES, to 30605 right now to see this week's special offer on Calitrin. Calitrin contains collagen, the most abundant protein naturally occurring in the human body, which decreases as we age. Taking Calitrin promotes better sleep, more energy, less joint pain, and best of all, weight loss. Calitrin has an amazing 86% success rate with their 90-day supply. And this week, take advantage of my special offer. Buy the 90-day supply and get an extra month free, plus free shipping. Ordering is so easy. Just text the word BATTLES, BATTLES, to 30605, and I'll send you a link to this special offer. You'll be glad you did.
They were some of the most powerful men who've ever lived. They waged war, forged peace, and altered the fates of billions of people. And yet, they were just as human, just as flawed as you and me. They were the presidents of the United States, and they are the subjects of the history podcast, This American President. In each episode of This American President, we explore how flawed men have managed this awesome responsibility. To listen now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search This American President on your favorite podcast platform.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it is. Yeah. And all of the men, actually, even the ones who were killed, eventually by the end of the war, were awarded medals of valor and citations of some kind, for their valor, because this, you know, of the 17 who made it to the German lines, at least, because there was more men in his unit. They just lost a lot of men as they were fighting up their way through mm-hmm. the lines. So I love character actors. And so one of the wounded non-coms was a veteran character actor named Jack Pinnock, who'd actually served in the First World War as a Marine. He'd served in combat. And he later became an actor, became a stuntman and an actor for John Ford. He was part of John Ford's stock company, and he accompanied John Ford into the Navy in World War II and actually filmed. He was one of the cameramen at the D-Day on Omaha Beach, and he was under fire taking film, as well as at Midway and some of the other actions that he was part of. He actually was the only veteran of military veteran, so he trained the other cameramen and soundmen for being in the military. The other thing was, so we told you to remember how things happened earlier in the film. Well, those German machine gunners, he couldn't draw a bead on them quite as well as he wanted to, because they were well entrenched. So what did he do? He made a gobble gobble, and they pop their head up and he shoots them.
Oh, that was classic. I love that. I mean, I guess I shouldn't love somebody getting shot, but it
was, no, just for yeah.
entertainment standpoint, it was amazing.
Yeah, and then the other thing was, he picked off that line of Germans advancing down the trench where he had a good enfilading position where he could hit any point in that line, and he hit the one at the rear, and he started making his way up until they stood up and surrendered. So again, really good foreshadowing earlier in the film, and circling mm-hmm. back to that foreshadowing.
If I remember correctly, Sean, didn't he run out of ammo in his rifle, and then he whips out a pistol and starts?
Yeah,
using it
too, right? In history, he actually had an M1911 automatic pistol, some automatic weapon. But in the movie, he takes a Luger from one of the German officers.
Okay.
I'm not sure why they made that choice, but that's what they did.
Okie doke. Did you have anything else on this part? Okay.
Yeah, I know, and you're right. The depiction of what occurred was much less bloody because it was a film, for an American right. film right. in 1941. But at the same time, it was pretty accurate in the way they depicted him making his way through the German lines to pick off those Germans that were surrounding this position that they were holding.
All right. Well, Alvin's fame quickly spreads among the troops. There's a great montage where they show different units marching along, and one of them says, well, he killed this many Germans. And the story gets bigger and bigger. And finally, the last one says, well, I heard he killed the Kaiser or something like that.
Yeah.
I, that's the one line I remember. The first time I saw this movie, Sean, was in high school. I was taking world history, and the teacher showed us this movie. And he also showed us All Quiet on the Western Front, but it was the 1979 version. But that's the one line that I remembered, all these years later. He killed the Kaiser. But anyway, Alvin arrives back at headquarters, and there's a general there, and the general has him tell the story of what he did. Alvin has killed about 20, and he says, the general praises him, and he says, well, I just did what I did to save my friends. He's very humble. He's awarded the Croix de Guerre. I can't say that right, but the Croix de Guerre, which is the French one of the top French medals. He's also given the Victoria Cross, which is a British award. And finally, the top American medal of all, the Medal of Honor, and it's pinned on him personally by General Pershing.
Well, and so, actually, James, he wasn't given the Victoria Cross.
Did I miss that? I'm sorry.
No, he was given the Distinguished Service Cross. So that's the medal that's one step below the Medal of Honor in the United States.
Oh, okay.
Yes. But he did receive a Belgian cross, one of their highest orders of valor. He received the highest valor medal from the Kingdom of Montenegro, and he received a whole number of other a thing from Italy, a thing from Belgium, a thing from Luxembourg. So basically everybody gave him a medal except the British. And the interesting thing is the Croix de Guerre, he's given the medal by Marshal Foch, who was actually the supreme Allied commander at that time on the Western Front. And he, of course, gives him the French, the kisses on either side of the cheek, and it makes him blush and look at him.
Yeah. I didn't realize that was actually Foch.
Yeah, he says in French that I, General Marshal Foch, give you this Medal of Avignon for your bravery, something like that.
All right.
Yeah, and of course the great line from the scene where he's telling his commander and the general what occurred, walking through on the battlefield of what had happened, and the colonel asks him why he did it. He said, "You told me when you left you were prepared to die for your country, but you weren't necessarily prepared to kill. What changed that?" And he says, "Well, I figured those Germans were going to kill hundreds, maybe thousands of Americans and my unit and other units." And he said, "So you did that to save lives?" And he said, "Yes, sir, I suppose I did." And he said, "Well, that must may be the most amazing thing you've said today."
Yeah, this guy, we got to keep the memory of Alvin York alive. He was just seriously kick butt. Before there was Rambo, long before
it was
Rambo.
Alvin York.
Yeah. And plus Rambo's not even real. So that makes Alvin York even better.
And I didn't know this. Major Buxton, who was his commander, who was the one who gave him the history book, actually later went on, he retired from the army, and during the Second World War, he was William J. Wild Bill Donovan, his second in command in the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services.
Oh, that is
he
cool.
He was a spy master.
Yeah.
He was a spy master during World War II, which is pretty amazing.
Oh, that is excellent. Hey, I have a question. I meant to look this up, and I just kept forgetting and getting sidetracked. Do you know whatever happened to Sergeant Early?
Yes, he got, I believe, a Silver Star. He actually had a kind of a dispute with York because he felt like York was getting a lot more of the attention than the rest of the unit had for their heroism. And he was one of the main people to drive getting the rest of the men recognized for their heroism as well. But, most of the men who were there pretty much said, yeah, this is what York did. He went off and went and killed the Germans. So and Early was unconscious. So he did survive the war, though.
Okay, I'm going to have to do a little more research on him. I don't think we're related, but you never know.
Probably distantly.
Yeah, maybe if you go far back enough. Well, all right, let's move on to the next part. So the fourth major part and the fifth part, at least as I've classified them, are much shorter. The fourth part takes place in New York City. York is given a promotion, and now he actually does really become Sergeant York now that the movie's almost over. He's given a hero's welcome. He's feted in New York City.
The ticker tape parade.
Yeah, ticker tape parade. They give him a key to the city, and they ask him, "What is there anything else we can give you?" And he just says, "Well, I just like to ride the subway," because he was intrigued by this idea of the subway. He's put up in a suite in the Waldorf Astoria. He gets to talk on the phone to Gracie and his family. And then he's visited by Tennessee Congressman Cordell Hull, who Sean mentioned earlier. And Hull tells him about all these different endorsement and other offers made to him. The offers totaled $250,000, which that's a pretty good chunk of change today. But back in 1918, 1919, that is, I don't know how much that would be today. That would be
several million. About it. Yeah, you think about it. He was going to struggle to earn a dollar a day, in hard work to get come up with $100 to buy some land. So.
But Alvin actually refuses the offer. He doesn't take a single thing. He doesn't want to cash in on his success. And that's very honorable of him.
Yeah, he doesn't want to profit off of the death of others. And so, right. Again, there's that reluctance, right? That reluctance towards glory and towards fame. He's not interested in that. It was not about killing to bring glory to himself or to his country. It was about what he saw as doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not many people would, I don't know, most people would at least be highly tempted to take that offer. And maybe he was tempted, I don't know, but in the movie he turns it down flat right on the spot. All right, so moving on to the last part. Back in Tennessee, Alvin returns to Tennessee. He's greeted by his family, Pastor Pyle, and many others. He asked to see the piece of land he had hoped to buy, and this is a really neat part. Gracie says, I'll show you the land, but you have to look down. She doesn't want, kind of like close your eyes, but she doesn't have him close his eyes because it's rocky land and he might trip or something. But she takes him to see the land, And he looks up and he sees that there's already a big house on it. I have in my note that the state bought it for him, but it was, I read later, it wasn't actually the state of Tennessee, right? Did they say the state in the movie? I'm not sure where I got that idea from. I think they said the state. They kind of implied
it. Certainly the governor, the pastor Pyle says, oh, I was going to marry you, but I couldn't say no to the governor. He wants to do it himself. So
yeah, there you go. So,
but also he was vetted by the Tennessee Society in New York, which was wealthy Tennesseans who were working and living in New York. So it could very well have been that they bought the land for him in the house. So who knows?
And then they all lived happily ever after. Yeah. So there it is. I was reading that actually the people that raised the money for the house actually weren't able to raise all the money. And York ended up being in a lot of debt and almost lost the house.
Yeah, he did. So York was a kind of a prickly character. He actually had, they tried multiple times from 1918 on to make his movie into a film. And he refused to authorize the film version. But finally, when Jesse Lansky, who was the head of Warner Brothers at the time, said that they would pay for the creation of an interdenominational Bible school, he finally agreed. And it was also the timing of when they did this film. Now, it's a myth. It's a story that York insisted Gary Cooper play the role. But in fact, Lasky recruited Cooper by actually sending a telegram to Gary Cooper and asking him to play the part, and he forged Alvin York's name.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I remember reading that. That's crazy.
But part of what York's decision to allow the film to be made, and he was heavily involved. He had veto power over everything that was in the movie, and he specifically wanted them to focus heavily on his conversion and his salvation experience and his time in the hills of Tennessee. And so that is 2/3 of the movie. I mean, the war itself is only the last part of the movie.
Right. I had forgotten that. And when I sat down to watch it a week or so ago, I kept thinking, when are they going to get to the war? When are they going to get to the war?
No.
This is just going on and on.
But York's position on the film, first of all, was he wanted the money for a Bible school. But more importantly, he was very involved in the readiness movement. And he was not in favor at all of the isolationist movement. He was very much opposed to that. He didn't want to go to war, but he very much changed his idea about war and about the war in Europe as the Nazis rose in power and as it was clear that Europe itself was heading to war. And he actually had studied and read up on what had caused the first war. And so his speech, he made speeches and said that, America needed to be ready. We did not need to be caught like we were in the previous war, and Europe did not need to be caught like it was in the previous war, unprepared to keep the peace, basically. Mm-hmm. And he spoke out against senators and against certain colonels who flew airplanes, who said America should stay out of the war. And so that is what actually kind of drives, I think, this film.
Yeah, if I can break in just for a second, he volunteered to join the Army in World War II, but he was turned down because of his age and because of his health. But then he was made a major in the Signal Corps.
Right.
And so he served but he stayed in the U.S.
Yeah, he was involved in war bond movements, but basically raising money. He actually was 30 years old during the First World War. So, he was in his 50s when the Second World War broke out. But I this film very much has a feeling of the reluctant patriotism, and that's what I kind of want to expand upon. That Alvin is a patriot, but he kind of goes to that position reluctantly. Alvin is reluctant to get to any of his positions in terms of fighting and killing, and that's because of his belief in his faith. But when he does, he chooses to do so. And he does it for the right reasons, which is to save lives, or it is to defend liberty and to defend the American ideals. The movements that he makes in these positions. And I think that this is speaking to an America in 1941 that is clear they are going to be going to the war. They know that they're I mean, they're already sort of at war with Germany in the ocean already, right, in the submarine warfare. But yes. They know that it is inevitable that this naval war, this undeclared naval war, is going to drag them into this conflict in Europe. And it's been clear pretty much since 1939, or at least since 1940 when France fell, that they are on a collision course with Germany. And I think that this film speaks, you know, we talk about movies that speak when they're made, it speaks to certain things about when they're made as much as about their historical subjects. And so using the story of Alvin York to say he was reluctant to become this hero, but when he did so for the right reasons, and he did so with resolve to do it and to do it quickly and to do it right, I think is speaking to those people that are on the fence about whether or not we should go into this war. And I think York definitely had, Alvin York, the historical Alvin York, had something he needed and he wanted to say, which is that America should step in to this conflict and we should do it for the right reasons, that the Nazis are, we need to stop the Nazis, we need to stop fascism, and we need to stop this bloody and destructive war. Now, obviously, you know, 3 months after this movie came out in September 1941, and nationwide, it was actually released in July in New York City, but several months after it came out, obviously Pearl Harbor happens, and that changes the dynamic of America's feeling about the war, because I think people knew we were also kind of headed for a conflict with Japan, but not in the same way that Pearl Harbor becomes. So I think that's what my point about reluctant patriotism is that it's not something that people want. It's, and so if you notice, the difference between this movie and All Quiet on the Western Front is that there's no one rah-rahing patriotism, sending young men to their death, right? But therefore, there does not need to be commentary on that, in that there does not need to be judgment that that's the wrong thing to do, because no one's really doing that. And so the people that are going to their deaths are going so through choice and through duty, right? Rather than being whipped into a frenzy by some teacher who's not, some person in the back who's not going to, you know, accept the same sacrifices. So I think you're absolutely right. This is certainly not an anti-war movie, but in a sense, it is kind of an anti-war movie. It's certainly an anti-isolationist movie, though.
Yep. Good words.
I love this movie. I love this movie. My grandfather, this is one of my grandfather's favorite movies. He said when he was a late teenager before the war started, he went and saw this several times, and he loved the gobble-gobble scene with the turkeys. And Alvin York was a hero to a lot of Americans at that point. Now, it's Audie Murphy came around. Mm-hmm. Good Texan Audie Murphy came around in the Second War and had a totally different experience.
Right. Well, all right. Anything else, Sean?
No, it's a great film. Gary Cooper is, of course, iconic as usual.
Yeah, a titan in the field of acting, for sure, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he was, it's that natural laid back. You know, he always played Gary Cooper, quite frankly. But he's still great.
All right. Well, that concludes our discussion of the classic war movie, Sergeant York. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. And we will be back very soon, hopefully, with another discussion of a World War I movie. Thank you very much, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you for listening to Key Battles of American History. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast catcher. And please be sure and spread the word about the show. If you can spare a few minutes, rate and review the show at Apple Podcasts. This greatly helps us to reach more listeners. And for show notes, maps, and further discussion, visit our website at www.keybattlesofamericanhistory.com. Thank you, and we look forward to joining you again in the next episode of Key Battles of American History.